Okay, welcome back. This is week 6 of Computer Science E52, or CS50. Today we're going to be talking about a lot of different topics that are very useful to tackling problems at 5, forensics. We'll start off with just a brief review of hexadecimal, which is the numbering system when we're writing down memory addresses and representing those on our screen and considering different memory addresses. So just to refresh our memory on what I mean when I'm talking about memory addresses, we remember from discussing pointers that every piece of information which we store in the computer, there's both a value, say we have that int x, which is equal to 7 that I use so often. This not only contains a value 7, but there's also a location at which this variable is stored, which we can represent by writing ampersand x, ampersand being the address operator. So by writing ampersand x, where x is our variable name, we get as the value some memory address. And the way we normally represent this memory address, recall that each memory address refers to the address of a particular byte of memory, is typically by writing down a hexadecimal number. So each memory address is really just a 32-bit number, so you can think of it sort of being like an unsigned int. But we don't write it out as an unsigned, as a decimal number, something like 1, 2, 3, 6, 5. We choose to write these down as hexadecimal numbers rather than this base 10 representation, which is what we use in our everyday life. We write them down in a hexadecimal base 16. So we might see something like 0x. This 0x doesn't denote any particular value. It's just used to indicate that what comes after are hexadecimal digits. And then we might have something like D, E, B, C, 1, 2, D, 2. And each of these different digits represents a digit. Each of these characters represents a digit of a hexadecimal number that can range between 0 and 15. So rather than having the digits 0 through 9, like we normally would in a base 10 numerical system, we have base 16, where we replace the value for 10 with an A digit, the value for 11 with a B, 12 with C, 13 with D, 14 with E, and 15 with F. So we can go anywhere from 0 to F, and then after we increase from F, we carry over and have a 1 in the next place, and then a 0 following after that. So if we recall from looking at binary numbers, if we had a binary sequence 1011, we thought of this as representing the value 2 to the 0, this 2 to the 1, this 2 to the 2, and this 2 to the 3. In the same way, we can think of each of these as representing 16 to the 0 times this value, 16 to the 1 times this value, 16 to the 2 times this value, and so on and so on. But even more useful than thinking about it like that is thinking of each of these is corresponding to some segment of a binary number. Because if you think about it, each of these digits can take up to 16 different values, which is very fortuitous because 16 happens to be a power of 2. So we can represent 16 different values using exactly how many binary digits? So in one digit, we can represent 2, in 2, we can represent 4, in 3, we can represent 8, and 4, we can represent 16. 2 to the 4th is 16, so with 4 different binary digits, we can represent values between 0 and 15. So actually, this 2 is equivalent to this binary number, and it happens to be such that if we write down the binary representation of each of these digits in this particular order, we end up with the binary representation of this hexadecimal number. And this is just a very convenient notation because it allows us to have this one-to-one correspondence between each of the digits in our hexadecimal number and the base binary representation. So that's just some justification for why we actually use hexadecimal values when we're considering memory addresses. If you end up working closer to the low levels within computer systems, if you take a class like CS61 or something equivalent to that class, you'll definitely see more of the advantages of using a system like this. But for now, just take it for granted and use this example as some motivation for believing me on that, at least. Okay. So moving on from hexadecimal numbers, let's talk about something a little more abstract. Enumerated types. So We have situations when we're representing values in the C programming language where we have some range of values which we're able to represent in a certain type of variable. For example, a char, we're able to represent a certain range of values, however many values we can place within one byte. For an int, we have up to 2 to 32 different combinations of values. But sometimes we want to just represent a very small, finite set of values or outcomes. So it'd be nice if we could create our own type with a finite set of possible values that isn't quite as extensive as one of the variables we already have. For example, if you want to write a program for a tic-tac-toe game, and you want some variable to keep track of whether you won, lost, or there was a tie, it'd be nice if you could create a variable that just took on three different possible values: win, lose, or draw. You could do something messy where you make 0 win, 1 a loss, and 2 a draw, and then you pound define everything, but that's not really all that elegant, and it will work, but it's just a little messy, and if we had some syntactical tool that would let us standardize that, it'd be a lot nicer. Unfortunately, we do in enumerated types. And this is good because, as I've written here, abstraction makes the code easier to understand and work with, and it makes your life a lot easier. So let's take a look at an example of something very similar to what I was just describing. Okay, so if I take a look at a program here, you'll see that I've declared a certain type which takes on three different values: win, lose, or draw. Oh, and just to further motivate this, actually. So possible sets of finite values which I could use to define an enumerated type might include, like I said, win, lose, or draw, yes, no, or maybe, small, medium, large, extra large, tall, venti, grandi, Windows, Mac OS, Linux. So anything you can imagine where you have a finite set of options that are distinct from each other, it would be useful to use an enumerated type for something like this. So in this example, we're just doing the game example. So the game outcome, win, lose, or draw. So the way we define this is by writing type def, type define, and then we define our enumerated type by writing enum, and then in these curly braces, so it's like set notation, if you're familiar with the mathematics of sets, then we fill in all the possible values we would like our type to take on, and then place the name of our enumerated type. So by placing this line in our file, we now have a type that's called outcome that we can assign three different, essentially pound-defined values, which are represented by win, lose, or draw. And those are the only values which we can assign to outcome, and we can treat those as being natural primitive values, essentially. They're not really, but you can think of them like that in the same way that maybe you'd assign a bool things like true or false. They're just the types of values which are associated directly with this data type. And what that means is that we can write functions which return values of type outcome. So normally we'd place a primitive data type or perhaps a struct there, something like int, char, bool. Now we're able to write outcome because we've created this type which takes these values. And you'll see here that apparently this function takes in a score, and apparently the rules of the game are such that if your score is over 9,000, then you win, and you return win as your outcome. Whereas if your score is less than 9,000, you lose, and apparently if your score is exactly 9,000, it's considered a tie, and we return draw. So we're able here to very simply and intuitively outline exactly what happens in each case in a way that's very easy for anyone who's reading it to understand, and for you as a programmer to it's very easy for you to keep track of as well. Since you have this layer of abstraction, which is provided by your enumerated type, you'll never get lost in the notation you've made up for yourself because it's very clear what exactly you mean. So just to further demonstrate this, let's take a look at the rest of the program. So we get a score from the user. They provide their own score. Then we check the outcome, and we assign that outcome that's returned, either win, lose, or draw, to some outcome variable called result. So again, we're able to create a variable with that data type that we've created. It's an enumerated type, and we can use it as any other data type. And then if the result is win, we print out a congratulations message, else another appropriate message depending on whatever happened here. And just to demonstrate this and show that it does in fact work, as always, your opponent has scored 9,000 points. What is my score? Almost there, not quite. And fail. That's tragic, but you know, that's life. All right, so any questions about enumerated types? Let's leave on a happier note than that. Yay. All right, so moving on from enumerated types, we'll talk next about structs. So structs is something that I think we've covered relatively extensively in lecture, but definitely worth revisiting. So how do we declare a struct? Suppose I want to create some struct of a certain type. What is a struct exactly? Let's take a step back and kind of approach this from the most basic level. So one of the most common questions we see when we're teaching functions early on in the course from students is like, okay, so I have this way to return ints and chars and bools or strings if I want to, but what if I want to return multiple values? Say I want to return an int and a char or two ints. Is there a way to do that? And at that point, we sort of have to wave our hands and say, well, not really. You can't quite do that. But the truth of the matter is you sort of can, because you can only return one thing from a function, but we have this device called a struct, which allows you to sort of create a basket of values that you give different names, different identifiers, fields of the struct, if you will. And you can place as many values as you want within this container, this data structure, and then return that from a function, if you like. So you sort of get this data type which contains other data types. So in this way, we're able to store values which are related to each other together within a structure and then pass them by value or reference, which can be very useful in many situations in programs that we'll be writing. So what's some sort of object you might be able to think of that has salient properties attached to it? Something that there's a lot of, you know, but each of them is a little different. Well, I can think of an...
Eggs?
All right, so eggs is a potential example. Unfortunately, that's not the one I came up with when I was making the slides, so we're going to have to go with a less exciting example from my childhood, which is Pokemon. So we have here a Charmander, which if you're not familiar, is a fire-type Pokemon. You could probably infer that. So Pokemon... there are over 150 of them, much more now, since I stopped playing them, they've apparently added a lot. But each Pokemon has its own name, it has its own type, and each of them have a certain number of hit points, which determines how much damage they can take before they eventually faint. So we can sort of think of how the developers of the Pokemon video game back in the mid-90s were going about making this game. They had to create these data structures which each represented a different Pokemon and which contained information pertaining to each specific Pokemon and held those together in a convenient way such that the fields could be accessed within the Pokemon. So let's take a look at how exactly this might work. So if we open up structs.c, so we see here that I've done something and created a struct Pokemon. So I have this notation where I write struct, then the name of the struct which I'm creating, then within curly braces, I have this set of different variables. So I have a char star name, so a string that's called name, another string or char star called type, so the name of the Pokemon, the type of the Pokemon, fire in this case, if we're looking at Charmander, and then HP or hit points, which is just an integer value. And you'll note here, again, the syntax is struct, name of the struct I want to create, and then I have this semicolon, which is actually important, following the end of my set, the end of those curly braces. So in this case, now I'm able to use this type I've created called struct Pokemon. Note that I do have to precede it with the word struct, so that the keyword is actually struct Pokemon rather than just Pokemon. That's very important to note. So this is a data type now essentially in the same way that my enumerated type was previously. It's a little different how it's implemented, but you can think of it in the same way and use it in the same way. So now I have, here I apparently have a function that's called print Pokemon. And it seems like I want to print out each of the different fields which is contained within my Pokemon struct. And you'll recall from previously that this Pokemon contains a char star name, a char star type, and an int HP. So I'm apparently able to access each of these individual fields. This Pokemon is called Poke. That's the name of the that's the reference to the struct which we've passed into this function. And I can refer to the name of that Pokemon by writing Poke, I guess, dot name. So we have this dot notation where I write a period after the name of the struct, and then following that, I have the name of the field. So I'm able to go into the struct and access the individual variables contained within the structure and get that value out of it. So that's some very useful notation. So other notation that's actually important to know, what if I had passed in a pointer to a struct Pokemon? So I pass in this struct by reference. So then I'd presumably have to dereference my Pokemon struct here before I could access the field contained within it. So I'd have something like star poke.name. And there's actually a nicer way to represent that. Rather than dereferencing and then using the dot notation, you can simply assume you have a pointer and then use this nice arrow notation, which is just represented by a dash and then a right angle bracket. And students have remarked to me when I told them that this is a simpler, more concise way to represent this, that it's actually using exactly as many characters because you just get rid of the star dot and replace it with the dash right angle bracket. And that's technically correct, but this is nicer syntax because when you look at this, this is a lot cleaner and more intuitive to understand than think about when you're looking at large segments of code which have mixed notation than looking at yet another dereference operator, which honestly is already an overloaded symbol since it's also used for multiplication and also for declaring a pointer as well for with struct Pokemon star there. So just having this arrow notation is just very nice, and you'll find that if you're using structs which are passed by reference often in your code, that it'll save you a lot of headaches because it'll just, you'll come to intuitively understand what that means. And it'll be very helpful when we're discussing linked lists a little later in this section. Okay, so that's how you reference a field contained within a struct. Here we're declaring this struct Pokemon within our file that we're calling starter. Starter Pokemon is the Pokemon an aspiring Pokemon trainer gets when he gets his Pokemon license on his 10th birthday. Once again, just motivating this demo a little bit. all right. So then we get the type of the Pokemon, apparently. So we're assigning to this type within our Pokemon starter, starter.type. Once again, using that dot notation, we're assigning to a value returned to by getString. GetString, as the name suggests, and as you should be familiar with by now, returns a string or a reference to a string. And then in the interest of game balance, every Pokemon starts with 20 hit points. None are markedly stronger than any others. Then we pass starter into the function we looked at previously, which was print Pokemon. And then we check the user's judgment by ensuring that they did in fact choose Charmander because everything else would actually be foolish. And then we return out of the program. So if we go ahead and make this file now, just to check it out. All right, so which Pokemon do you want?
Pikachu.
Well, Pikachu. Oh, bold move. All right. What type of Pokemon is that? That's an electric Pokemon, if I remember correctly. Not Charmander. Well, good luck, sir, but we'll see what happens. Good luck at Brock's gym, all I'm going to say. No one knows what I'm talking about. All right. Someone out there does. All right.
You know
eggs. I should have just ran with the eggs demo, honestly. I should have called myself lucky for. Next year, maybe. Okay. Are there any questions about structs, how they're declared, initialized, accessing fields? Okay. Great. Okay, so let's move on and talk about one of the interesting things that we can do with structs, and that's implementing a linked list. So normally when we're storing a set of values within memory, we find ourselves using an array structure. So we just have this contiguous region of memory. So this the set of boxes that we should be very familiar with that are just sitting next to each other in memory, and each one contains some value inside of it. And they just sit next to each other like this. So this is very nice. It's very space efficient. There's kind of some problems here, though, because there's limitations of what you can do with an array efficiently. For example, what if I really wanted to place a value 5 between 3 and 1 for whatever reason? So if I want to do that, then I have to get myself a bigger array first, and then I have to move both of these over here, and then I have to put the 5 here. So if as this becomes large, that becomes really difficult because I have to copy everything over one space, or a large portion of the array over one space anyway, just so that I can place this 1-5 value in the middle between these two. So there's no really efficient method of inserting a value into an array. And conversely, if I wanted to remove this 3 now, well then I take it out, but I don't want this empty space to be here. I can't really have an empty space. I'd have to put something there. So if I want to close that gap, now I have to move this 5, this 1, and the 4 over left one space again. So there's not really an efficient way to do that, and it's a bit of a pain if you want to place new values in here or keep them in a specific order. So if you have a dynamically changing data structure, an array doesn't really cut it for something like that. Fortunately, by using structs, we can implement a linked list structure. So essentially, this is a data structure that is composed of a set of structs which are linked together, as the name might suggest. So each structure is composed of a piece of data that we're keeping track of, as well as a pointer to another piece of data, which is next in the sequence defined by the list. So each of these individual structs might look something like this. We have these two boxes next to each other. So you have the first field of the struct, and then the second field, and this larger rectangle makes up the contents of the entire struct. And let's say we call this one val, and it's an integer. And this one is a pointer to a node. So let's call it a node star. And note that I didn't write struct node star here. I just wrote node star, but presumably it was struct node. This is actually something I wanted to touch on. So I'm going to go back just for a second. If we pull up this silly demo one more time. So you'll recall that I had said that we had to write struct Pokemon, which is sort of some cumbersome syntax, having to write struct there every time. Maybe it's helpful if you want to remember that you're dealing with structs and distinguish that from other data types you're using, but oftentimes that's not really the case. So if we want to get rid of this struct, this sort of annoying struct syntax, what we can actually do is use typedef here as well, and then place the name we'd like for the struct at the end. So now I'm type defining this structure, which I've not given a name, so this generic structure, I'm type defing and assigning the name Pokemon. And if I do just a little quick Emacs magic here and replace struct Pokemon with just Pokemon. So now I've drastically simplified sort of the syntax being used here. I just have Pokemon starter. And then I make this. And we see that it does continue to work the same way. So if you want to avoid having to use that struct keyword every time you're declaring a new struct of that type, then you can use type define in the way that I just showed you. And that sort of makes things just a little bit easier. And it allows us to use what I've described here, node star rather than struct node star, which just cleans up all the syntax that we're using a little and makes it a little more nice. Okay, so once again, we're dealing with a structure here, which we call a node, which contains some value which we're placing in our list, and a node star pointer which points to some other node in our list. So suppose this is the only one on our list right now. So this is set to null. I use this to represent null, so this points to nothing. And then we have some value here, why not 6? Okay, so then if we want to make a list out of this, suppose we had some other node. This one has an 18. It also doesn't point to anything. But if we change one of these pointers so it points to the other one, we now have a linked list. So you can access each of the different values, inspect each of the different values, perhaps iterate through the list by starting at the first one, checking the value here, and then maybe you're performing a search over this list. If that's not the one you want and you want to check the next one, then you don't, like in an array, move just to the next space in memory. You would actually dereference this, or you would get the memory address given to you here, which now gives you a reference to this structure, which allows you to check this value within this structure and then find out where the next one is located. So by making use of this pointer, which is contained within the struct, you're able to get access to the next structure, which may be anywhere in memory, but now you're able to jump straight to. So you're sort of able to dynamically take different pieces of memory scattered throughout the system and then link them in this way so that you have this dynamically created data structure which can hold arbitrary values in a specific order. And that's essentially what a linked list is. So let's take a look at an implementation of a linked list and some basic things that we'd want to do with them. Okay. So we're talking about singly linked lists, just to be very specific. So that's opposed to a doubly linked list. How would I make a doubly linked list, by the way? We're assuming this is what constitutes a singly linked list, having this node that points to the next value.
Having a return pointer?
Hmm?
Having a pointer
A pointer back?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we call it singly linked because we just have one pointer in each node that points straight ahead. But if we wanted to go backward in the list, well, we're kind of out of luck because we don't remember where the last thing was. We don't really hold on to that to that very that address. But if we had two pointers contained within each struct, one which points forward and one which points backward, then we're able not only to traverse this way in our linked list, but we're able to say, oh, I actually liked that value. I'd like to go back to it now. And then we just take a step backward because we have that pointer and we know the address of the other structure. But right now we're just dealing with a singly linked node case. Okay, so we've created this struct just like we've created our Pokemon struct previously. We call it SL node. It contains some int val and some pointer to a some struct of type SL node. So one of the ways we could insert a value to a linked list is by appending right to the end of it. So we would create the new node using malloc, just give us space in memory. So we have this new node that we've just created, and we have a reference to it, which it exists somewhere on the heap. Check that it's not null, just a sanity check, if we remember back to how we use malloc. And then, like I specified previously, we use this arrow notation to access fields within a structure which we have a reference to, which we have a pointer to. So we're accessing the val and setting it to some new val, which is defined previously. It's a value we'd like to add to the linked list. And we set the next pointer to null, because initially we don't want this to point to anything. So we want to place it at the end of the linked list, apparently, hence append. So we check our list start. We have a pointer to the start of our linked list, which we're given that as an argument to append. So we're passing in the value we'd like to add and the location of the linked list. And then we check that it's not empty. If it is empty, if we have null there, then there's nothing currently in the linked list. So you'll see we actually make list start equal to the location, equal to new node. And since new node is a pointer, that gives it the address, which points to the beginning of our linked list, which is the node we've just created, since it's the only node contained within the list. And otherwise, while list pointer next does not equal null, list pointer is set to list pointer next. So what's happening here exactly? So since list pointer is not null, then list pointer points to some structure which is a node. So then we get list pointer next, which is the pointer to the next element within our linked list data structure. So if that's not null, then it means we have another node in our list. So then we set list pointer equals to list pointer next. So now this pointer is the one we're holding on to. So now we know where this is. So we're dealing with an entirely different node. And we keep doing this until we get to a situation where list pointer next is equal to null. So when we've reached the last node in our linked list, at which point we set this pointer equal to the address of our new node. That's also 18. 19. And we have successfully appended a node to the end of our linked list. So if we don't care about the ordering of the values in our list, say we just want to keep track of, like, I don't know, names of people we've met, and we're keeping a list of people we know, and we want to add them to this list, and we don't really care about keeping them alphabetically, it doesn't make a difference to us, would append be a good function to use to do that? No. Okay. Why not? Okay. most likely because it's a very leading question and you know my teaching style by now. So the reason for that is if you don't care what order they're in, it doesn't really have to be at the end. It can be anywhere in the list. So you should put it wherever in the list is most efficient, wherever takes the least time. So appending to the end of the list is an operation that's in big O of n, if we think back to asymptotic notation, where n is the length of the linked list currently. So you have to go here, then you go here, then when you finally get to the end, after nth iterations of doing that, you're finally able to append it to the end of the list, and then you're done. But you don't really need to do that. What if we just put it at the start? The great thing about linked lists is that we have the freedom to insert anywhere in the list we want. So if I wanted to instead take this structure and place it at the front, Well, it's simple as, so this is some pointer that points us to our, the start of our list. It's as simple as making this new node point to the previous start of the list, and then deciding that our list now starts here. So we're essentially pointing to the beginning of the list with our new node, and then hijacking this list pointer, so we're saying, no, we're the beginning of the list now. And so we're able to insert at the head of the list, which is actually a constant time operation. So it's asymptotically faster than inserting at the end of the list. This is something to keep in mind if you use a linked list to implement any of your data structures in problem set 6, spell checker, since we're going to be focusing more on optimizing efficiency and trying to minimize runtime that week. And especially important if you wish to compete on the big board, which you'll be hearing much more about in the coming weeks. Okay. Yeah.
Up top, is it double star next to list start? What's the reason for that?
Okay. So, I wrote this a while ago. I forgot to use that. So that would, I believe that would actually be a pointer to a pointer. So this is, list start is a pointer because it's this box which is pointing to the beginning of our linked list. And I want to pass that by reference because I want to be able to change what's in this box. So actually when I pass this into my function, I actually have to pass a pointer to this pointer. So yeah, that actually gets a little hairy to think about when you're writing the code. Hopefully that explanation is satisfying. But yeah, so that double star actually does mean what you might intuitively think, that it's a pointer to a pointer. It's a struct star star, or struct SL node star star. Does that make sense? Okay, great. Any other questions about the implementation here or anything about linked lists? Okay, great. Well, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move on to file input output, which should actually be very useful for this coming problem set, since you'll be dealing with a reading in image files into your program and producing some output. Has anybody looked at the forensics problem set, by the way? Okay, cool. So essentially the problem set tasks you with reading in information which is contained within this file, which is supposedly stripped from I think it's a CF card, some sort of compact media that's used with digital cameras. And then with this raw data, you're supposed to look through it and figure out where in it are contained file descriptions, and then take that information and output it to create a JPEG file. So basically snip out that section of ones and zeros that represent some JPEG picture, and then output it into its own file, such that it can be opened up by your computer and you can see what the image is. Which is actually really, really cool the first time you get it to work, so hopefully you'll have a good experience with this. It's a really fun piece that most students really enjoy it. And there's another part of the program as well where you'll be actually changing the contents of image files to resize them. So if you have a bitmap that's sized 3x3, you'll have to do something to the contents of that file such that you create an equivalent image that's scaled by some factor n, so maybe it's 3 times bigger, 4 times bigger, 5 times bigger, by changing some of the information in the file before you output it. So there's some fancy stuff being done with file input output. So let's take a look at the basics for this. So input and output. Normally, when we read things into a program, we read from std in, standard in, and we write to standard out. So what does that mean exactly? Well, these are what are referred to as streams. And standard in, data is fed into standard in like this. It's just whatever comes in from your keyboard. So anything I type here is being fed into the standard in stream, and that is by default where your program is going to be taking all its information from. And that's how any of the input operations we've implemented for you, like get string or get int or anything like that, is reading in its data from standard in. And anything that's printed out on the screen, like the error message I'm generating right now, comes out to standard out. Standard out is just this area that's on the screen in the terminal. So anything the program sends to standard out gets displayed on the screen and I can read it there. But we don't always want to do that because programs that just take input from the keyboard and write out things to the terminal aren't very interesting, and that's why most people don't use them in this decade or most of this century so far, actually. You may have had a couple jobs, or some people may have had a couple jobs where you have to use programs in the terminal. It's not very pleasant. Generally, we tend to use graphical user interfaces, but you know, as we've seen recently, some programs in the terminal are very useful. But obviously, there are other things we'd like to do with programs. We'd like to create files. We'd like to generate content using programs. There's a lot of different applications for that. But how exactly do we do it? Because it seems like we're limited so far with what we've learned in C to just printing out things on the screen and reading into input from the user directly. So we want to be able to write to files and read from files. So let's take a look at an example which shows us some functions that allow us to accomplish exactly that. So I've taken the time to prepare a sort of a word processor, and I hesitate to label this like that because it's actually the worst text editor that's probably ever seen the light of day, and I call it Typewriter. So I'll just show you how Typewriter works first, actually. So I execute Typewriter, and it gives me this just this this prompt here to go ahead and start typing on my my typewriter. So I say, oh, okay, here's the first line. And then essentially I hit the carriage return like I would on the keyboard, and I get this nice this birching feedback. all right, and then I type, you know, oops. Here goes the second line. And the carriage keeps returning back to the beginning of the line, and I keep doing this until I eventually type exit, and the program knows to close. And actually, if I open up findStationary.txt, I only use the best, we now see that we have all of the lines that I typed in nicely placed on their own lines. So, okay, here's the first line. Then when I hit enter, it did create that new line character in the file, so things go up onto the next line as if I had hit the character on a typewriter, hence the name of the program. Like, kind of a stupid program, not nearly as robust as some other editors perhaps we're used to working with. It's no Emacs, it's not even a Microsoft Word or WordPad. But you know, it'll do, and we have successfully outputted data to a file called findStationary.txt. So there's something interesting going on here that we haven't seen before, or at least which we haven't seen before in section. So how exactly is this accomplished? So let's take a look within the contents of my main function. So I'm creating a reference to something called paper. It's a file star. So this is included within standard io.h. So this is something, standard io.h. So this is accessible to you pretty much if with any program you're writing, since presumably you're going to want at least printf in your program. So I use this function called fopen, and I provide as the first argument the name of a file. This does not have to be a pre-existing file. If I did not have findStationary.txt, it would be created for me. And then I provide another argument that describes how I want to use this file. I use a W here because I want to write to it. If I wanted to read from the file, I'd use an R. If you check out the man page for fopen, you can see a bunch of other different flags that you can send defining different ways you might want to use the file, which is definitely something you should check out when you're starting the problem set. So much like I would if I were getting a reference to some region of memory using malloc, I do a sanity check here where I check whether or not paper is equal to null. If fopen fails to access that file for me, if I did something wrong or something's wrong with the system and prevents that from happening, it will return null, and I won't be able to proceed with the program, and I should catch that case and return if that's what happens and have the program exit gracefully as opposed to crash my system. So then I declare this string input because I want to continuously get input from the user, have them type out those nice lines using this old-timey keyboard program so that they can then hit enter and enjoy the wonderful effects. While true, so just keep doing this until something causes us to break out of the loop. Input is equal to get string, familiar again. If strcomp input is exit, so if the value we're getting from the user is exit, we're just catching this case where they type this special word, which I've arbitrarily decided causes the program to quit. If that's zero, so strcomp finds that these two strings are the same, then we close the file. Anytime you open a file, you want to close it as well, in the same way that when you malloc something, you want to free it as well. You always have to close any file handle that you open. So there, once again, there should be a one-to-one correlation between fopen calls and fclose calls in your program. Else, if I'm still taking input from the user, they haven't typed exit, then I want to use fputs, which is fput string. So place a string in the file, write out a string to the file. Specifically, write out this string to this file. So write out input to paper. And then after that, place backslash n to paper. So you'll note that when I print something to the string, it prints it after whatever we printed previously. So it's always writing to the end of your file, wherever that happens to be at this point in the program. So essentially what's happening here, we're taking a string from the user, we're writing it, and then we're getting the character return, and then we're playing a nice sound effect. And you'll note that we're printing here to standard output because we're using printf. But we're using fputs to print to our file specifically, which is defined by paper, which is of type file star, which is defined in standard io.h. Okay. Everyone happy with everything there? Does that seem reasonable? Any questions about file input in this case? Or file output is what we're dealing with right now. Okay. So the other side of this is file input, which is basically very similar. But we want to be familiar with both sides of this because you will be dealing with problems in the problem set that require you not only to write out information to a file, but take in information as well. So rather than doing something as simple as typewriter, I had a little fun, and maintaining the theme of the week, apparently, I decided to work with Pokemon again. So get ready, guys. So I took a picture of Charmander here, but a much simpler picture of Charmander. On the old Game Boy games, the images were about 40 by 40 pixels, and they were rendered in four startlingly different shades of gray. So it's a very simple file containing just all this pixel information for these four different colors. So it's very easy to go through the file, look at each pixel, determine which of four colors each pixel is, and then do something with it. So what this looks like is like this. So I'm defining a struct which allows me to access information for the blue component, the green component, and the red component of a pixel. Blue, green, and red components being what defines the color of the pixel as a whole. I have some information upside on the top, just defining header sizes and information I need to know to understand what's located in each part of my file. And if you're interested in more in the contents of a bitmap file, you'll certainly get references you can use as you read through the problem set, because this is highly relevant to what you'll be doing. And then don't want to show too much of this, lest I give anything away. But essentially, I'm going to be reading in different regions of memory which contain pixel information, and then checking the contents of each of these regions of memory. So I read them into a structure. So I'm treating it, the memory I've read in, as a struct, and then accessing different fields, because I know previously from my knowledge of how bitmaps work where that information is going to be contained within this memory. So I can do this. And then if each of these values are certain values, which I figured out just by actually going into Paint and just checking what the color codes were for each of the pixels, just had to figure out four colors. I then plug these in, and I print out a different ASCII character for each different color. Or I print just a space character. So what essentially is happening is I'm converting the contents of an image into ASCII characters and then printing them to the screen. So I'm taking input from a file rather than from the user, and then I'm performing some operation on it and doing something semi-interesting by printing it out to the console. Okay, yeah, and that's essentially what's happening in this program. So let's go ahead and take a look at the results. So if I run Pokemon BIMP, okay, so if you step back at least a little bit, that sort of looks like a Charmander, doesn't it? You've got the flame on the tail there, and it's actually an accurate representation of the original file, just in a different format. So we're able to change the way we're representing the same data and read in all this input from a file and have all this done very quickly for us, because we have this in a format that is usable already in a bitmap file. And in fact, just to further justify using this to create different output, I can actually change this value. I also have a Bulbasaur picture for all of you. Get excited. And if I run this again, using different input, different file, I get a similar result where, if you're familiar with Bulbasaur and you squint, you can kind of see it there. He's sort of leaping. Okay. All right, so, okay. Are there any other questions about the way this was implemented, getting information from a file or creating output with the file's information? Okay. That's just some technical stuff that's going to be given to you just as something that you'll have access to in problem set 5. So it has something to do with the way the information is stored within the struct that defines the way the fields are stored relative to each other in memory. And it happens to be important in this case because it's the way that the color information is stored in the file. It's not something that you have to worry about being responsible for, though. So this is something that's given to you in the problem set, so I wouldn't worry too much about it. The question was, why is attribute packed written here? Any other questions? All right, well, that about covers everything we have for this week, so I'll see you all next week. Good luck with the problem set.